From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Ira Melman. The British lead the way in saying a Russian plane may have intentionally been brought down in the Sinai Desert. The British Prime Minister David Cameron declared Thursday it was more likely than not that a bomb brought down a Metrojet flight packed with Russian vacationers, a scenario that Russian and Egyptian officials dismissed as premature speculation.
We don't know for certain that it was a terrorist bomb. There's still an investigation taking place in Egypt. We need to see the results of that investigation. The reason we've acted before that is because of intelligence and information we had that gave us the concern that it was more likely than not it was a terrorist bomb. Now, if that turns out to be the case, and even before we have that confirmed, of course we'll look at all of the implications, because my job is to keep British people safe wherever they are in the world.
Cameron said he had grounded all British flights to and from Egypt's Sinai Peninsula because of intelligence and information indicating that a bomb was the likely culprit in the crash Saturday that killed all 224 people on board. The move stranded thousands of British tourists at the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. Cameron said he had every sympathy with the Egyptians, who rely heavily on tourism, but added that he had to put the safety of the British people first. Later, Cameron and Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke about the crash in a telephone call. The head of Russia's Air Force said Thursday the military has sent anti-aircraft missiles to Syria in order to protect the Russian planes that have been conducting airstrikes there since the end of September. In Syria, the Russian Interfax news agency says the Russian Defense Ministry says its Air Force destroyed an Islamic base near Damascus. This is VOA News. There's a new survey out that shows Americans are souring on President Obama's efforts to fight Islamic State insurgents in the Middle East, with some believing he's doing too little, while others say he has broken his pledge to end U.S. military involvement in the region. The Associated Press GFK poll found that more than 6 in 10 of those surveyed in mid-October reject Obama's response to the Islamic State advances in Iraq and Syria. More than a year ago, he authorized a massive aerial bombardment of Islamic targets in both countries, and recently, after the survey was completed, dispatched 50 special operations troops to Syria to advise Kurdish and Arab forces fighting the insurgents. However, support for his campaign against the Islamic State has been waning, with 38% approval at the moment, compared to an even split for and against in September of 2014. Months after U.S.-Israeli relations appeared to hit a new low, President Barack Obama will welcome Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House next week for talks centered on what has long been the key issue of contention, the Iran nuclear agreement.
Press Secretary Josh Earnest says the meeting will focus not only on Iran, but the fight against the Islamic State and further enhancing Israel's security.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has previously described the level of security cooperation that's been offered by the Obama administration as unprecedented. That, I think, is an indication of the president's personal commitment to the security of Israel and to the unshakable bond between our two countries.
Tensions and violence are escalating amid a series of Palestinian knife attacks on Israelis and Palestinian deaths at the hands of Israeli security forces.
Obama, like many American presidents before him, may make one last push towards peace, but analysts say without political will from both Israeli and Palestinian leaders, the effort will likely be futile. Arup Pandey, VOA News, The White House.
The parliament in the Maldives voted Thursday to impeach its vice president, Ahmed Adib, who was arrested last month on suspicion of being involved in an assassination attempt against the country's president. The vote was 61 members in favor, none against. Came a day after President Abdullah Yameen declared a 30-day state of emergency because of a threat to the national security. Yameen's wife and two other people were wounded in a September explosion on his speedboat. The president wasn't hurt in what officials have deemed an attempt to kill him. The U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter visited a U.S. aircraft carrier in the South China Sea Thursday as tensions grow with China over Beijing's maritime expansion in the region. Carter was traveling with his Malaysian counterpart, Hisamuddin Hussein. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we speak with an expert about the meaning of possible ISIS involvement in the downing of a Russian plane. We discuss the possibility of a political resolution to the Syrian crisis. We continue our conversation with Chef Bibi about his chocolate chip cookie.
When I see them bite into it, literally their taste buds just begin to dance.
And we'll hear who won what at the Country Music Awards. It's right here on The Voice of America. As Britain hosted Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, British officials say evidence points to the detonation of an explosive device as the cause of Saturday's mid-air breakup and crash of a Russian jetliner after it departed Sharm el-Sheikh Airport in the Sinai, bound for St. Petersburg, Russia. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us now here in the studio. Victor.
Susan, tragically, all 224 people on board that aircraft perished. On Wednesday, British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond spoke after meeting with his government's Crisis Response Committee.
We have concluded that there is a significant possibility that that crash was caused by an explosive device on board the aircraft. Earlier this evening, we delayed the return to the UK of British-bound flights that were on the ground at Sharm el-Sheikh while we conducted a review of security at the airport. We have people on the ground working with the Egyptians, and I'd like to pay tribute to the Egyptian authorities who have been extremely cooperative throughout the day and have moved heaven and earth to meet our demands on the ground. But unfortunately, and very reluctantly this evening, we have concluded that we have to change our travel advice, and we are now advising against all but essential travel by air through Sharm el-Sheikh Airport.
On Wednesday, a White House spokesman said U.S. air safety experts had warned commercial airlines months ago that they were at potential risk associated with extremist activity if they flew over the Sinai. Regional analyst Joseph Olmert of the University of South Carolina told me that if it's determined the IS group was behind the destruction of the aircraft, it will only be the first jihadist effort against Russia for its intervention in Syria.
Much more will be done against the Russians. They opened the Pandora box by their intervention in Syria, and they will unleash revenge. There will be revenge activities by Islamic organizations. So whether this one is the first or not, there will be more.
Do you suggest that perhaps this is one of the reasons why Russia is pushing fast for some sort of political solution in Syria?
That could be one of the reasons. I think that the Russians are having a strategy in Syria which is designed to show that, A, they can decide the situation militarily, but they can also bring about a political solution.
Egyptian President el-Sisi had indicated that the Islamic State initial claim of responsibility was merely propaganda. Mr. el-Sisi's image, has that been damaged? He claims that the situation in Sinai is under full control.
Hey, look, the Egyptians have a sure interest here in minimizing the damage. It's a damage control activity on the part of the president, and one can understand it. Don't forget that tourism is a very important part of their economy, and tourism in the Sinai mostly. So if flights will be canceled now, or there won't be flights by a lot of international carriers to the Sharm el-Sheikh Airport, that's a major damage to the Egyptian economy. So they have an interest in minimizing damage by pretending it wasn't a terror activity. If security in Sharm el-Sheikh Airport was compromised, where else can it be compromised in Egypt? That's a real problem here for the Egyptians.
Joseph Olmert says by intervening in Syria, Russia has created a situation that invites jihadist revenge attacks. Trinity University regional analyst David Lesh told me he agrees.
It had to come in some form, in my opinion. That it happened in the Sinai Peninsula was somewhat unexpected. But once the Russians had intervened in Syria, it was predictable that elements of particularly the Islamic State and other jihadist elements who, you know, made up of such groups as Chechens and others who had been wanting to kill Russians for some time would carry out attacks against the Russians, either Russian troops or installations or whatever. And I think that will come. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And I think the interesting point now is what will the Russians do? you know, when the evidence mounts that this was an attack that was precipitated by Russian military interaction, will they enhance and increase their military footprint in Syria? And is this the beginning of the quagmire in which the Russians will get themselves into that many people have predicted? You know, so I think the Russians are, and Putin is in particular, is very much concerned over this and very much concerned over what will likely be increasing attacks against Russian interests, not only in Syria, but as if this proves to be the case, Russian interests outside of Syria and in Russia itself. And will this compel Putin and the Kremlin to increase their military footprint in Syria? Will it compel them to draw back?
Russia's involvement only extends about a month, their air campaign really beginning in earnest on September the 30th. Were you surprised how quickly the IS took off after Russian targets?
I'm a little surprised that it was IS, because as we know now, the most of the Russian strikes until this time have been directed at non-IS opposition to the Assad regime. There have been a few attacks against IS positions in Syria, but 95% of the Russian airstrikes have been against Jaish al-Fatah, the Army of Conquest, and other elements that have been most threatening to the Assad regime.
David Lesh says if the IS group is found to be responsible for downing the aircraft, it will be a further incentive for Russia to seek a political solution in Syria.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Let's have a look now at what people are saying about the Russian plane crash on social media. Michael Lippin joins me in the studio with an update. Michael, what Twitter hashtag should people search for?
Hi, Susan. Well, the most widely used hashtag for tweets about the crash remains 7K9268. That was the flight number of the Metrojet plane. The Topsy Analytics website shows that it's been mentioned in more than 3,000 tweets in the past day and 125,000 times in the last week. Other popular hashtags that I've seen include Metrojet and Sinai Crash. Now, just to pick up on a point that analyst David Lesh mentioned to Victor Beatty, expressing surprise that the Islamic State may have carried out a major attack against Russia, assuming that the crash actually was an IS bombing. Now, I've seen that sentiment also expressed in some recent tweets, including by a satirical Twitter account that claims to be the voice of Russian President Putin. That account uses the handle @DarthPutinKGB, and it has 40,000 followers. And this is what it tweeted: Russia isn't bombing ISIS, so why is ISIS bombing Russia?
What's the general feeling of Russian social media users about this crash?
Well, you know, it's been a major topic of discussion among Russian-speaking Twitter users in the past few days. Some of them believe the crash may have been an act of revenge by terrorists. One user with the handle Markov_Alexei tweeted, "There was an explosion in the back of the cabin, immediate depressurization and death within seconds." And then he asks the question, "Was it a response to Russia for its involvement in Syria?" While others blame the disaster on poor quality control, Twitter user Good Uncle Klaus tweeted, "Carelessness and corruption during safety checks is worse than terrorism." I should also point out that many Russian speakers are not playing the blame game. They're just expressing the grief that appears to have gripped much of their country. A user with the handle Ram_Nastya said this about the victims of the crash: "The tears are rolling down my cheeks. Rest in peace." Susan?
Sad, Michael. Thank you very much for that report, though. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
It's been long known that evolution has guided human development to adapt to changing environments over the years. Now, new findings by U.S. and French researchers suggest that our language abilities have also adapted to our local environment. The researchers examined languages spoken throughout today's world and compared their sound structures with climatic and ecological factors. Ian Madison from the University of New Mexico says that he and his colleagues found that the number of distinct consonants in a language and how they are grouped together are related to the precipitation, temperature, tree cover, and elevation of an area in which the language evolved. The researchers say their findings support a theory which suggests animal species adjust the sounds they make so that they can be transmitted more efficiently in the environment they live in. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has highlighted the need to decide which of the various opposition groups fighting in Syria should be part of future peace talks and which should be considered terrorists.
Lavrov spoke at a news conference after meeting in Moscow with the UN envoy for Syria about the process of finding a political solution to the conflict that has left more than 240,000 people dead since March 2011. International Edition's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Michael O'Hanlon, director of research at the Brookings Institution, about the new U.S. strategy in Syria and prospects of a political transition, and he joins me now. Welcome, Mohamed.
Thank you.
See, Mohamed, the Vienna talks hit a hurdle with regard to the future of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad because both Moscow and Tehran are insisting he should stay in power.
Well, that position has changed this week when a Russian foreign ministry spokesperson said Tuesday that Moscow does not consider it a matter of principle that Assad must stay in power. However, Michael O'Hanlon gave a vote of no confidence in the Russian statement.
Well, I'm skeptical about what Russia has said. I'm skeptical about their sincerity. But I also think that if we keep in mind the idea of a confederal model, then, in fact, we could have a role for Assad in the Alawite sector, and that perhaps would provide the natural compromise. So I still think that there is a way, if you take this sort of Bosnia model or confederation model, and you attempt to employ that, there may be a way to compromise.
O'Hanlon argues that the only hope for Syria as a united country is to have a very loose, weak central government with autonomous zones as a realistic outcome for a political solution.
The U.S. is deploying some special forces into Syria. Some experts said deploying less than 50 U.S. special forces to Syria could add combat effectiveness in the fight against ISIS. But others called it a band-aid.
Well, Michael O'Hanlon was in the middle and said while it's not enough for a comprehensive strategy for the U.S., it has its own merits.
But it's a step in the right direction because, let's say it's 40 people, they can begin to establish better contact with the various opposition forces. They can begin to understand the lay of the land, the geography, the logistical requirements. They can perhaps give some overall advice on a couple of general principles of battle. They can forge personal relationships, which I think are crucial in this sort of situation. And perhaps in a couple of limited cases, they could even do a better job of forward air control or tactical air control. But I think to do that kind of tactical work, they're going to need to be increased. But even so, even without the increase, you could have a little bit of that effect initially.
However, O'Hanlon said the new strategy is not yet working because it is still evolving, and if the goal remains to defeat ISIL and ultimately to put pressure on Assad to negotiate a political transition, there is a lot to be done down the road.
Well, thank you, Mohamed, for that analysis.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, vanilla might be a key to a really good chocolate chip cookie. And country music's biggest night. Today we continue our conversation with Chef Francis Nelson Beebe, chef and owner of Mr. Nelson's Cookies, about chocolate chip cookies and their popularity. Chef, what makes your chocolate chip cookies better than my mother's?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't think I would compete with any mother's chocolate chip cookie. Mom is mom, and you're going to have a taste that's uniquely mom's. And it's interesting because I have that question asked many, many times, even though I have an online business. Occasionally on the weekends, I'm at farmers markets. And when people see me advertising the perfect chocolate chip cookie, they say, well, my mom makes the chocolate chip cookie. And I guess my response to that is that's probably true and I won't compete with mom, but it's always good to have a backup. And my backup is Mr. Nelson's Cookies. And what I believe makes it, you know, perfect from my standpoint, I was actually a Mr. Mom. I was a single parent some 30 years ago. And my son and his buddies just love chocolate chip cookies. And I literally made thousands of them and tried, you know, call it tens of, not hundreds of different recipes. and then kind of took one, something from one, something from another, until I created what I thought was the, you know, the quintessential chocolate chip cookie recipe. I have three levels of chocolate in my chocolate chip cookie, and a very exclusive vanilla. I use Tahitian vanilla. Most vanillas come out of either Madagascar or Mexico. And Tahitian vanilla has a lot of layers and complexities that the others do not. And it seems to love chocolate. It just adores chocolate. And when I watch people take a sample, again, at the farmer's market, I have them smell it first, because 80% of your taste comes from smell. And then when I see them bite into it, literally their taste buds just begin to dance, almost metaphorically, if you will, where the vanilla seems to be hugging the different levels of chocolate. So it's a recipe that I created a long time ago, put it in my back pocket. But when I've now shared it in the last 15 months, that I've basically been live in terms of making Mr. Nelson's cookies, it seems like I may not have taken mom's place, but I'm a pretty close second.
And you only make chocolate chip cookies, is that correct?
That's correct. You know, and my dad said, you know, it's okay to be a one-trick pony. Just make it a really good trick, you know. And I seem to have gotten the endorsement of a lot of people, where they don't even question, do you sell an oatmeal? Do you sell a peanut butter? They just seem to be very, very satisfied that my cookie, which just weighs a couple grams under a few grams under a quarter of a pound, it's an awful lot of cookie. And people's, when I see the taste and the eyes roll back in the head, I know that I've conjured up all those earlier memories that we're talking about, maybe even surpassed them.
Well, thank you so much, Chef Beebe, for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A navigation device for your bicycle that attaches to the handlebars. It's called Smart Halo, and it's made by a company called Cycle Labs. It's a circular screen edged by a ring of LED lights. It connects to an app on your smartphone via Bluetooth. A right turn is indicated by a right side green semicircle. For a slight left turn, a green quarter circle appears at the top left, and U-turns light up a red semicircle on the bottom of the display. Here's Cycle Labs' Gabriel Albarol.
So we've made sure our device was simple yet smart. How? By reducing its interface to its simplest possible form, a circle. This luminous halo allows us to communicate an impressive amount of information.
Smart Halo is also a bike locator, a theft prevention device, and a fitness tracker. Its bright headlight turns on and off automatically on a battery charge that normally lasts 3 weeks. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosson.
One of the biggest events in country music happened last night, the Country Music Association Awards, the CMAs. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to fill us all in. Welcome, Nikki.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you. Hey, first, who won what?
Okay. All right. So, Female Vocalist of the Year, Miranda Lambert. Male Vocalist of the Year, Chris Stapleton. Vocal Group of the Year, Little Big Town, well-deserved, Girl Crush. Their song actually won for Song of the Year. Vocal Duo of the Year, Florida Georgia Line. New Artist of the Year was Chris Stapleton. And Entertainer of the Year was Luke Bryan.
Do any of these surprise you?
Okay, so this is what excited me.
Uh-huh.
And that is, and this ties into Justin Timberlake coming on the show. Chris Stapleton was like the underdog that cleaned up. So he was able to take away three awards for Male Vocalist of the Year, Album of the Year, New Artist of the Year. Now, even though he's a well-respected songwriter and singer, he's written for Adele. He's written for a lot of big names in country music, and people love his work. However, his solo project, this is his first solo debut, came out in May and has not had the commercial push and the awareness that his other nominees have had. So in these award ceremonies, sometimes you're like, okay, is it gonna the most popular going to win, or is it the one with best quality? And so his album Traveler was well respected and well received. So the fact that he wound up picking up three of the awards encouraged and inspired everybody. All country music lovers, the artists and the nominees alike. So much so that when Luke Bryan got up to accept his award as Entertainer of the Year, he even expressed his excitement about how well Chris has done that evening. So that, I think, was the biggest surprise. In addition, of course, to Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, I was going to say, Justin Timberlake. He blew people out of the water with his duet.
Oh, my goodness. So, and the thing is, Justin Timberlake is doing the duet with Chris Stapleton on the stage, and they're doing the cut, Tennessee Whiskey. It's like a bluesy, I don't want to say jazzy, it's more of like a blues cut on the country music spectrum. And tears it up. It was amazing. So no one was expecting it. And then for it to be with Chris Stapleton and for it to be that cut and for it to be as phenomenal as it was, that just added to the excitement and the inspiration. And by the way, Justin Timberlake has showed up and has been a part of a couple of high profile country music events. And, you know, he's a Tennessee native. So there is buzz that he might be working on a country album without really letting us know.
Well, he can really do anything, any kind of form of music.
He can.
Why are these CMAs so important?
Okay, so the CMAs, so their objectives are pretty much to guide and enhance the development of country music throughout the world and to demonstrate it as a viable medium to advertisers and consumers in media. And basically, they see themselves also as an agent for unity within the country music industry, and their award show really encapsulates all of that. And so the actors have their Emmys, the country music artists have the CMAs.
Yeah, it really brings attention to country music, and most people might not be exposed
Definitely.
To it.
Exactly. And this is a great way, especially with Justin, that's a great tie-in. And there's been a lot of crossover country pop artists, but this is really the night where country artists get to shine on their own.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Nikki.
Thank you.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced this month that it is listing the military and great green macaws as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. Both bird species are endemic to Central and South America. The agency found that both species are in decline, primarily due to habitat loss, fragmentation and degradation, small population size, and poaching. Further, the existing regulatory mechanisms designed to protect these macaws are not adequate to prevent those threats from impacting them throughout their ranges. As a result, both macaws are at risk of extinction throughout their ranges. The military macaw inhabits tropical, semi-deciduous forests in Mexico and South America. Although it is a large distribution, its population, ranging from 6,000 to 13,000 adults, is highly fragmented into small, localized groups ranging from a few pairs to approximately 100 individuals. The great green macaw occupies humid, tropical forests primarily in Central America and parts of northern South America. Its population, now ranging from 1,000 to 3,000 individuals, is in decline. The service recognizes the valuable, ongoing conservation efforts to protect these species by a number of private individuals, national and local governments, and non-governmental organizations, including the Wildlife Conservation Society and Fundación Pro Aves. These efforts include providing training to local communities to monitor populations and studying species via satellite transmitters to determine the species' home range and specific habitat. However, in spite of these notable contributions, great green and military macaw populations continue to decline. As a result of this listing, certain activities involving these two bird species will be prohibited without a permit, including import into and export out of the United States, take, defined by the Endangered Species Act as harm, harass, kill, or injure, within the United States, and interstate and foreign commerce. By regulating these activities, the Endangered Species Act ensures that U.S. citizens and individuals subject to the jurisdiction of the United States do not contribute to the further decline.
Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome back. On today's As It Is program, we will be talking trade and politics. The Obama administration says the recently negotiated Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal would boost U.S. jobs, but it's facing a hard sell with Congress and candidates campaigning to replace President Barack Obama when his term ends. With details of how things stand, here are Mario Ritter and Anna Mateo.
More candidates running for president oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal than support it. Democratic frontrunner Hillary Rodham Clinton is the latest to declare her opposition to the deal. The TPP was negotiated by the Obama administration. As Secretary of State, Clinton described Obama's TPP as the gold standard of trade agreements. But this month, she said the final deal does not appear acceptable. "I don't believe it's going to meet the high bar I have set," she said. Senator Bernie Sanders, Clinton's top challenger for the Democratic presidential nomination, opposed the agreement. He maintained that stance even before the deal was finalized. "We need trade policies that promote the interests of American workers, not just the CEOs of corporations," he said, after 12 nations announced agreement on the Pacific trade deal October 4th. Republican presidential candidates are divided. Businessman Donald Trump, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee opposed the deal. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and Ohio Governor John Kasich are mostly in support of the agreement. Others, including former Surgeon Ben Carson, said they are waiting for more information before expressing a view. But the U.S. Congress will likely vote to accept or reject the deal long before the winning candidate takes office in January 2017.
The trade agreement eliminates or reduces tariffs and other barriers to trade among 12 nations. Ministers from Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, and Malaysia approved the deal. It was also approved by ministers from Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, the United States, and Vietnam. The approval came on October 4th. Congress has never voted against a major trade deal. The TPP might lack support from U.S. politicians who are running for president or who are trying to keep their congressional seats. Many U.S. businesses support the trade deal. They say it will export more of their products to Asian markets. But unions fear job losses and cuts in wages and benefits if the trade deal is approved. Democrats are very much interested in the support of unions, and the labor movement is opposed to this deal, said Brian Brocks, a political science professor at Tulane University. He said that most voters may not understand the complicated agreement, but many are likely to see it as being helpful to big businesses rather than American workers. Also, many Republicans are not inclined to support a proposal by President Barack Obama, a Democrat. That makes it harder for a Republican candidate for president to support an agreement his administration negotiated. For Republicans, candidates not supporting something backed by President Obama is never a bad idea, Brox said. In other words, voting against Obama's projects is good for Republicans. Trump tweeted comments about the deal that played to Republican primary voters opposed to President Obama. He tweeted that the Obama administration was incompetent. TPP is a terrible deal. Rubio, the Florida senator, said he wants to see more details before taking a firm position. However, he told CNBC, "I'm generally very much in favor of free trade."
The Trans-Pacific Partnership sets rules for investments from one country to another. It includes protections for intellectual property, such as patents and computer software. The deal covers more issues than is the case with some free trade agreements. It is basically a free trade agreement on steroids, Columbia University International Economics lecturer Andrea Bubala said on #VOA. U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman said the trade agreement will improve the U.S. economy. It will allow more U.S. products to be exported than foreign products will be imported to the U.S. U.S. products face tariffs as high as 70% on autos, 50% on machinery, and 700% on certain agricultural products, Froman said. Eliminating or reducing the high tariffs will make U.S. products more competitive, he said. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Ana Mateo.
You are listening to VOA from Washington. Reducing some climate pollutants could save millions of lives, says a new report by the World Health Organization, the WHO. Gases like soot or black carbon, methane, and the ozone in city smog are called short-lived climate pollutants. As we hear from Ann Ball, not only do they contribute to climate change, but they can cause ill health.
WHO says emissions from these climate pollutants cause cardiovascular and respiratory diseases. These include heart disease, pulmonary disease, respiratory infections, and lung cancer. The WHO says these pollutants are responsible for many of the more than 7 million premature deaths each year that are connected to air pollution. The UN Health Group also says the pollutants can decrease agricultural crops. These pollutants exist both outdoors and indoors. WHO Environment Chief Maria Nera says the pollutants have a strong impact on climate change. She says the good news is that they only stay in the atmosphere for a few days to 10 years. That is much shorter than carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, that can remain for hundreds or even thousands of years. WHO has a number of available and affordable ways to mitigate these short-lived climate pollutants. At the top of their list, cutting vehicle emissions by requiring higher emissions and efficiency standards. More emissions are released when engines are running. Indoor air pollution also contributes to bad health and premature death. The WHO reports that nearly 3 billion low-income households rely on dirty fuels. Coal, wood, and kerosene used for cooking and heating are examples. They say cleaner and more efficient stove and fuel alternatives could cut down on the health risks. The WHO report also calls for encouraging high and middle-income populations to include more plant-based foods in their diets. It says this could reduce heart disease and some cancers. It could also slow the methane gas production that comes with some animal-sourced foods. I'm Ann Ball.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
How can I help you? How long has it been hurting?
These are among the sentences that medical students are learning at the Enrique Cabrera Medical School in Havana, Cuba. Graduates from the medical school practice medicine in Cuba, as well as in countries in Africa and South and Central America. Juan Carlos Dominguez Lopez is head of the English department at the school. Professor Lopez says that medical students begin by learning how to ask about the patient's problem. They learn questions such as,
"What can I do for you? Where does it hurt? Can you describe your pain? Are you taking any medication?"
Future doctors also learn to use the command form of verbs like,
"Sit down. Tell me about your family history. Hold out your arm." The most important tool for learning about English medical language is real-life experience, according to Lopez. He says students go along with doctors to visit patients in the university's hospital or clinic. On these rounds, the students observe how doctors and specialists talk with patients, discuss each case, and make reports. The value of this real-life experience is to connect theory to practice. Students learn theory in the classroom, but find out how doctors help patients in the clinic. For example, students may learn germ theory, the idea that germs cause disease. But as they follow doctors, they may see how often the doctors wash their hands and how they wear masks and gowns or scrubs to prevent infection.
As students become more advanced, Lopez says they learn the English grammar structure reported speech. Reported speech is how we tell others what someone else said. When doctors write a report or talk with others, they use reported speech.
The patient said that she has had 2 children.
In addition to learning from real-life experience, students at Enrique Cabrera Medical School read and listen to articles on medical topics from VOA Learning English and watch videos.
Professor Lopez says Cuban students prefer to practice American English rather than British English. After all, Cuba and the United States are neighbors, only 90 miles away from each other. As the relationship between Cuba and the U.S. improves, Lopez hopes that more student scholarships and courses in the U.S. will be available for his students. Already, he has taken training at the U.S. Embassy on the Test of English as a Foreign Language, or TOEFL, which is required for international students entering American universities. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. South Carolina withdrew from the United States on December 20th, 1860. The state seceded because a Republican, Abraham Lincoln, had been elected president. The Republicans were a new party, and Lincoln was the first to be elected president. They wanted to stop slavery from spreading into the Western territories. Southern states believed they had a constitutional right to take property, including slaves, anywhere. They also feared that any interference with slavery would end their way of life. This week in our series, Frank Oliver and Larry West tell what happened after South Carolina left the Union.
South Carolina faced several problems after it seceded. The most serious problem was what to do with property owned by the federal government. There were several United States forts in and around the port of Charleston. Fort Moultrie had fewer than 70 soldiers. Castle Pinckney had only one. And Fort Sumter, which was still being built, had none. The commander of the forts asked for more men. Without them, he said, he could not defend the forts. The army refused. It told the commander to defend the forts as best he could. He was told to do nothing that might cause South Carolina to attack. If South Carolina attacked or planned to attack, then he could move his men into the fort that would be easiest to defend. That would probably be the new one, Fort Sumter.
The governor of South Carolina planned to stop any movement of federal troops. He ordered state soldiers to stop every boat in Charleston Harbor. They were to permit no United States troops to reach Fort Sumter. If any boat carrying troops refused to stop, the state soldiers were to sink it and seize the fort. 6 days after South Carolina seceded from the Union, the commander of Charleston's forts decided to move his men to Fort Sumter. They would move as soon as it was dark. The federal troops crossed the port in small boats. The state soldiers did not see them. The governor was furious when he learned what had happened. He demanded that the federal troops leave Fort Sumter. The commander said they would stay. The governor then ordered state soldiers to seize the other two forts in Charleston Harbor. And he ordered the state flag raised over all other federal property in the city.
President James Buchanan, who would leave office in just a few months, was forced to deal with the situation. His cabinet was deeply divided on the issue. The Southerners wanted him to recognize South Carolina and order all federal troops out of Charleston Harbor. The Northerners said he must not give up any federal property or rights. The president agreed to meet with three representatives from South Carolina. They had come to Washington to negotiate the future of federal property in their state. The attorney general said the meeting was a mistake. These gentlemen, he said, claim to be ambassadors of South Carolina. This is foolish. They cannot be ambassadors. They are lawbreakers, traitors, and should be arrested. You cannot negotiate with them.
The Attorney General and the Secretary of State threatened to resign if President Buchanan gave in to South Carolina's demands. The president finally agreed not to give in. He said he would keep federal troops in Charleston Harbor. And he said Fort Sumter would be defended against all hostile action. On the last day of 1860, he ordered 200 troops and extra supplies sent to Fort Sumter. The War Department wanted to keep the operation secret. So the troops and supplies were put on a fast civilian ship instead of a slower warship. It was thought that a civilian ship could get into Charleston Harbor before state forces could act. But a Southern senator learned of the operation. He warned the governor of South Carolina. When the ship arrived in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina soldiers were waiting.
The soldiers lit a cannon and fired a warning shot. The ship refused to stop. Other cannons then opened fire. The commander of federal troops at Fort Sumter had a difficult decision to make. He had received permission to defend the fort if attacked, but his orders said nothing about defending ships. He knew that if he opened fire, the United States and South Carolina would be at war. The decision was made for him. South Carolina's cannons finally hit the ship. The ship slowed, then turned back to sea. It returned north with all the troops and supplies.
The commander of Fort Sumter sent a message to the governor of South Carolina. "Your forces," he wrote, "fired this morning on a civilian ship flying the flag of my government. Since I have not been informed that South Carolina declared war on the United States, I can only believe that this hostile act was done without your knowledge or permission. For this reason, and only this, I did not fire on your guns." If, the commander said, the governor had approved the shelling, it would be an act of war, and he would be forced to close the port of Charleston. No ship would be permitted to enter or leave. The governor's answer came back within hours. He said South Carolina was now independent. He said the attempt by the United States to strengthen its force at Fort Sumter was clearly an act of aggression, and he demanded that the commander surrender.
During the crisis over Fort Sumter, Congress tried to find a compromise that might prevent war. Lawmakers proposed a new line across the country. South of the line, slavery would be permitted. North of the line, slavery would be illegal. Many Republicans supported the proposal, even though the Republican Party opposed the spread of slavery into the Western territories. One Republican, however, rejected the idea completely. He was Abraham Lincoln, who would take office as president in March. Lincoln said there could be no compromise on extending slavery. "If there is," he said, "then all our hard work is lost. If trouble comes, it is better to let it come now than at some later time."
The trouble would come soon. One by one, the states of the South seceded. By February 1st, 1861, six states had followed South Carolina out of the Union. A few days later, representatives from the states met in Montgomery, Alabama. Their job was to create a new nation. It would be an independent republic called the Confederate States of America. The convention approved a constitution for the new nation. The document was like the Constitution of the United States, but with major changes. The Southern Constitution gave greater importance to the rights of states, and it said there could be no laws against slavery. The convention named former United States Senator Jefferson Davis to be president of the Confederate States of America. Davis did not want civil war, but he was not afraid of it. He said, "Our separation from the old Union is complete. The time for compromise has passed. Should others try to change our decision with force, they will smell Southern gunpowder and feel the steel of Southern swords."
Jefferson Davis left his farm in Mississippi to become president of the Confederate States of America on February 11th. On that same day, Abraham Lincoln left his home in Illinois to become president of the United States. As Lincoln got on the train that would take him to Washington, he said, "I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return. The task before me is greater than that which rested upon our first president. Without the help of God, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Let us hope that all yet will be well."
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Frank Oliver and Larry West. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs can be found, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.
Thank you.